Chapter 9, Blindsided. Dan announces, "Blue leader, feet wet." Rich reports, "Big sky, feet wet." I wonder what the heck they're talking about when I look up to see they've retracted their wheels into their floats in preparation for a water landing. I squeeze the unlock handle and pull on the retract lever to raise my gear as well. Wishing my call sign sounded more dignified, I sheepishly announce, "Tweety bird, feet wet." One by one, we peel off into a steep diving turn, swooping towards the inviting glassy waters below. I lose my stomach every time I perform this maneuver, but the sensation's beginning to grow on me. These little planes can be flown like a roller coaster without the tracks, and I'm the one who gets to construct the turns, twists, and drops. With the majority of the trip's work behind us, it's time to play, but first we need to unload our gear at the campsite. We head across the lake with the sun directly above. The winds are non-existent, and the air temperature has climbed considerably. I look forward to shedding these bulky clothes, donning my swimsuit, and airing my toes in the warm breeze. I don't know, I guess there's something I like about flying out in the open with my bare feet exposed. Lake Monticello lies in a north-south direction and is 10 miles long and 4 miles wide, with numerous fingers, peninsulas, and hidden coves. The lake's shoreline has both reddish clay areas and stretches of white sandy beach. Above the shore are oak and pine trees, which give off an invigorating essence. During the week, there are few boaters to disturb the lake's calm surface. We prepare to splash down near the beach where we'll set up camp. Water landings are simple. First, double-check that the gear is up, otherwise you'll be in for an unpleasant tumble across the water. Next, set up into the wind, if there is one. Slowly reduce power and speed, and ease the floats onto the water, keeping the elevator back to prevent the nose of the floats from digging in. With a light spray of mist to signal your landing, you slide to a swift stop. A little burst of throttle and water taxi the plane to the beach. That's it. Excited to be here, we quickly unload our planes. We pull our sleeping bags from out of the wings, careful not to drop them into the water, and then set up camp under shady oak trees. Changing into our swimsuits and water sandals, we apply sunscreen, especially to the front of our shins and the tops of our feet. Flying out in the open with one's legs exposed, sunburns are likely. Dan assigns the first mission. With our remaining fuel, we'll fly a reconnaissance sortie around the lake to secure the perimeter, establish air superiority, and then plunder the enemy's supply depot. Rich confirms. Okay, so we'll check out the lake and stop at the marina for beer and fuel. Cool. Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. I add, sounds good to me. I'll fly close air cover support. We give our planes a good shove, and as they drift off, we wade into the warm water and jump into our seats. We start the engines and take off away from the beach towards open water. Water takeoffs are about as easy as water landings. Slowly add power and hold the stick back so as not to dig in the tips of the floats and prevent the water spray from chewing up the prop. As you gain speed, ease forward on the stick to level the plane. Permit the floats to get up on step where they'll have the least contact with the surface of the water, allowing the plane to accelerate faster. Once you achieve flying speed, gradually pull back and you're no longer a boat, but a happy and free flying machine. We head north along the shore to circumnavigate a portion of the lake in a clockwise direction. The marina is not far to the south, so it'll be one of our last stops before we retire for the day. Dan and Rich weave in and out of every cove, flying below treetop level. I do my best to mirror their paths, which take us around tall trees, over jagged outcroppings, and skimming along quiet bays. Following close behind, I'm mindful to stay above their altitude to avoid their annoying wake. A slight ripple materializes on the water's surface from the afternoon's light breeze, but my plane is untroubled by its effects. With all I witness on our tour, I wonder how many other fortunate souls have experienced the same glorious feeling of freedom and grace from a flight such as this. Before I know it, we're at a quaint little marina. We each set down just outside the 5-mile-per-hour buoys and taxi our planes to the fuel docks. Greeting us are a couple of clerks, and gathering nearby are some curious onlookers, most of which are retired folks who live at the lake. All the people we meet are friendly and inquisitive, and I sense they probably welcome a little excitement to their day. I suspect living here at the lake, although very beautiful, can become somewhat dull over time. As the curious surround the three of us, I feel like we're dignitaries from a foreign land. Dan and Rich take care of buying the supplies, while I'm responsible for refueling the planes. The folks here are helpful, offering to hold our plane steady while we prepare to start our engines. It's a challenge to avoid dock pilings and boats, but we manage to miss everything as we taxi from the dock. As we clear the 5-mile-per-hour zone, Rich proposes our departure strategy. Okay, boys, it's now showtime. Let's take off in tight formation and then turn around and head towards the marina and give the folks a little air show. Rich is the most impulsive of the three of us, and he often thinks up entertaining and silly things for us to do. Rich's spontaneity balances out Dan's methodical personality. Me? I'm just tagging along and trying not to get hurt. Dan replies, "All right, Big Sky, you've got lead." Rich's plane is plowing through the water in front of us as Dan and I flank on either side. "Blue and Tweet, are you ready?" Dan's abbreviated reply is, "Yes, sir." I echo, "Yes, sir." "Okay, easing up the throttle." Our propellers rip and tear at the water's spray as our planes churn up a frothy wake. Gaining speed, we each porpoise gently, then leap off the water to level 5 feet from the surface. Rich calls for a banking left turn back toward the marina. On Rich's left wing, wedged near the water, I have no room for error now. As we roll wings level, heading for the marina, Rich calls for full throttle. The chorus of growling intensifies with our speed, while I tuck as closely as I safely dare to Rich's wing. As if the crowd on the dock can hear him, Rich keys the radio to announce, "Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll direct your attention to center stage, I would like to proudly introduce the amazing Dreamland Non-Precision Flying Team." A 5-mile-per-hour buoy streaks beneath us, and before we risk getting too close to our audience, Rich instructs, "On my count, Blue breaks right, Tweet breaks left, and I'll pull straight up. 1, 2, 3, break." Out of the corner of my eye, I see Rich's control stick slam rearward as he disappears above. At the same time, I pound my stick and rudder to the left. The turn's G-forces weigh heavily upon my body as I whip around, and a blur of trees and water whisk by before I have to throw the stick back to the right to roll wings level. For a brief moment, I saw hands waving and faces smiling on the dock below. Heading back out toward open water, my heart works to process the excess adrenaline. That was a rush, but I'm glad it's over. Thank goodness we didn't end up doing anything too stupid. Our impromptu air show director, Rich, was careful not to fly too closely to the docks, but I'm sure it still provided some good entertainment for the crowd below. The intense afternoon sun is beginning to broil the day. We join up in formation to fly out over the lake, heading for a secluded site to splash down for a needed swim. With the engine stopped, our three planes float in close proximity. We lash the planes loosely together with rope and proceed to plunge into the inviting translucent water. As I look down, my feet are clearly visible with rays of sunlight streaking through toward the lake's bottom. Swimming and joking and laughing, we cling onto our bobbing planes. Back up onto the floats, we lay in the soothing sunshine as our planes gently rock in a wake created from a distant boat. I didn't notice until now, but there's a candy Pez dispenser strapped to the nose of my plane. It's a Tweety Bird Pez. The guys must have bought it at the store and secretly attached it to my plane's nose gear bar when I wasn't looking. I can't believe those guys were messing with my delicately balanced, aerodynamically sensitive flying apparatus. I guess my pre-flight back at the marina wasn't so thorough. Without revealing my discovery, I bring up the subject of call signs. "Are you guys sure my call sign should be Tweety Bird?" Rich sharply replies, "Yep." "Instead, how about Attack Hawk?" "Negative." "Maybe Red Devil?" "Nope." "Firebird?" "Nay." "Crimson Eagle?" Rich sternly says, "No, you are Tweety Bird. We already told you. You don't get to pick a call sign. You're issued one. Another insubordinate remark and you'll be banished from the squadron." I try once more. "Buzzard Beast?" Dan interjects, "Or how about just calling yourself Babblebeak? Now will you guys shut up already?" With that command from our fearless leader, silence returns. As the water droplets evaporate off my sun-soaked skin, I lay and think of what a great day it's been, both exhilarating and exhausting. I used to be so afraid of flying, and now I can't recall when I've been more relaxed. My breathing becomes deep as I begin to doze off. All I see is a shade of dark red as the sun permeates my eyelids. My mind eases off into a deep dream state. A dream which is somewhat fuzzy, not black and white, but full of vibrant colors and surreal sounds. In the dream, it's a bright, beautiful day with a hint of a breeze. I'm with my wife floating about on the ocean in a sleek white boat with tall, majestic sails. Enjoying each other's company, we sip wine and soak up the tranquil surroundings. As with most dreams, little makes sense. It shouldn't be of concern, but questions crop up. How did we get out here? Whose boat is this? When did I learn how to sail? Where are we? Our sunny day transforms to an eerie, quiet darkness. The sky becomes an ominous navy blue, and the ocean is a pitch-black undulating morass. Even the sound of waves lapping on the hull is absent. Drifting about lost and helpless, our dread grows, and so does the distance separating Jennifer and I. Nothing is said as we stare off and wonder what will become of us. Out of the darkness above, we hear the soft sound of feathered wings gently flapping. An extraordinary bird appears and gracefully perches on the railing near the bowsprit. Jennifer and I crawl from the cockpit onto the forward deck to see this magnificent bird up close. It has well-worn features with friendly, familiar eyes which peer steady at us. Speaking in an aged female voice, the bird says, "Mark, are you enjoying your adventure?" Jennifer looks at the bird in amazement and then focuses her stare upon me. Curiously, I'm not surprised by the revelation that this bird talks and knows my name. "No, we're lost. Where are we? What'll become of us?" The bird narrows its eyes. "Why do you worry so? This is your chance to enjoy your time together." "But look how far we are from the safety of shore. We don't want to die." She answers, "Mark, you needn't concern yourself, for dying is certain. Why do you hold on to your desire for control?" Frustrated, I say, "But I don't know how to sail." The bird lowers her head slightly and commands, "Mark, fret not over what might be, but what enjoy what is. Your imagination delivered you here. Now only positive thoughts can save you." I ponder what the old bird has said. Could she be right? Do I worry over the bad things that might happen? I should learn to appreciate the moment. I take a relaxing deep breath and think good thoughts. At that instant, a gust fills our sail and the boat lists to port. Jennifer and I scamper back to the cockpit as I pull on lines, crank the winches, and man the tiller. The boat lurches forward with a powerful swoosh. The bird takes off and flies ahead as the mighty boat speeds along, slicing through the waves. The wind is from our right, and the mainsail is angled to the left. I hoist the jib and trim it alongside the mainsail. As the bird banks over to the right, I innately recognize that I need to tack to the right in order to follow. Mainsail? Jib? Tack? I wasn't aware I even knew what these terms meant. Now it's all second nature. I pull the tiller to the left, swinging the bow to starboard. The sails ruffle and flop as the boat's momentum completes our turn. The boom swings over our heads across the cockpit, and with a loud flop, the sails fill with air once again, and we thrust forward. I straighten the rudder and release the jib sheet. Pulling tight on the jib starboard line, I complete the tack. Jennifer, with her hair flowing in the swirling currents of air, shouts, "Whoa, Mark, you've got this baby flying now." "Damn right we're flying." I yell up to the bird, "This is a miracle. How could I learn this so easily?" The old bird wisely replies, "Don't you know, Mark? When you dare to dream, fantastic things can happen." Realizing now that I know this old bird, I impulsively call out, "Thank you, Amelia. This is incredible." We follow the flight of Amelia until the wind fades and we drift to a stop not far from a strange tropical island with tall palm trees and a white sandy beach. Dan and Rich are on shore waiting in the rolling surf. Sitting nearby is an antiquated twin-engine airplane with its motors puffing blue smoke as it patiently awaits the return of its missing pilot. As our boat sits dead in the water, the large bird circles and utters, "Mark, it's time for me to go. I'm probably overdue. I'll miss you, my friend. Goodbye." Amelia, her wings proudly stretched wide, soars up into the boundless sky. As she effortlessly climbs, I feel my sorrow grow and fear return. "Please don't leave, Amelia!" Her feathered head turns back one last time to declare, "It's all right to be afraid, but don't ever let fear prevent you from living and growing." As Amelia vanishes above, I hear Dan and Rich calling out, "Uh-oh, here comes a boat. I wonder what they want. Hey, Mark, your turn to answer the 20 questions. Mark!" Hearing their voices, I slowly awaken from my dream. Confused and groggy at first, the sun rudely glares into my squinting eyes, and I see Dan and Rich sitting on their floats, legs and feet dangling in the water. I run my hands through my hair and splash water on my face to adjust back to reality. As my eyes blink to regain their focus, a ski boat loaded with a family of three motors up to our flotilla of planes. The father calls out, "Hey, sorry to bother you. We saw you guys at the marina, and my son Jake wanted to have a closer look. That was quite an air show you put on. Those planes sure look like fun, but I bet it's hard to get life insurance." With a chuckle, I reply, "When has insurance ever saved anyone's life?" "What's that, mister?" the boy asks, pointing to the nose of my plane. "This plane is the world's most incredible and versatile candy Pez dispenser. Care for one?" Jake's family is amused when they see the toy dispenser, and laughter erupts from Dan and Rich, realizing I'd finally acknowledged their juvenile prank. Jake reaches out and tilts Tweety's head back to extract the candy. The family thanks us and motors off, leaving the three of us bobbing about. "You know, Mark, I think you found your calling. You can fly around and give out candy to all of the underprivileged children of the world," Rich quips. The sun begins to disappear below the mountains to the west. With the flying day about to end, Dan decides it's time to move on. "Let's don our night vision goggles and head back to base." From previous sunset excursions we'd flown, I knew that Dan meant we should exchange our sunglasses for the clear lenses of the safety goggles he supplied us from work. Dan, who was surely impressed with himself, referred to them as night vision goggles. I smile and mumble, "This is just another example of what a couple of nerds I've somehow gotten myself mixed up with." As the twilight sky turns a blackish blue, the first stars begin to appear and we enjoy the tranquility of the lake. Airborne, the three of us playfully chase each other and perform mock dogfights until the creeping darkness makes it necessary to return to camp. We secure our planes for the night, which entails giving them a good yank up onto the beach. We gather the few sticks and firewood we can find, and Dan constructs a campfire even the Boy Scouts would be impressed with. Rich pulls out thick porterhouse steaks he'd packed on dry ice, and we grill the meat over the fire. With a voracious appetite, we heartily eat our mouth-watering feast. After our meal, we have a couple of beers and a new dilemma presents itself. What now? With no cable television to force-feed us entertainment, how will we make it until bedtime? It doesn't take long for the three of us to settle in for the remainder of the evening. After the fire dies down, we lay on our backs to gaze skyward at the heavens above. There are constellations to name, shooting stars to tally, and satellites to identify. We begin to philosophically discuss the deepest meanings of various intellectual theories concerning mankind today. I start out with a question for Rich. "Hey, Rich, do you remember that first day I met you guys out in the cornfield? You were dropping watermelons on stuff, and you said something that I never quite understood. You said that you thought your life might be at greater risk if you didn't fly. What did you mean by that?"
"I don't really remember saying that. What do you think I meant?"
Reflecting for a moment, I propose, "Well, I guess I couldn't understand it at the time, but maybe I do now. If you didn't do something a little crazy in your perfectly logical and structured life, you might go insane. When you fly, there might be a chance of dying, but if you didn't fly, you would surely die from the monotonous existence." Rich sarcastically quips,
"Someone better throw Mark a line because he's getting in awfully deep."
With the discussion turning too profound, Dan helps rescue the conversation by changing the subject. "So anyway, Rich, you grew up in Montana. Why would the sky be bigger there than any of the other 48 contiguous states?" I chime in, "Yeah, Rich, what's up with that? Why do you guys get a bigger share of the atmosphere?" Rich goes on to defend his home state, and then rambles on in a tangent about the vastness of the universe and his theory about creation. Sounds familiar, though, kind of a cross between Star Trek's Starfleet Command Charter and the Jedi teachings from Star Wars. Once we're satisfied we had solved the meaning of life, we retire to our warm and comfy sleeping bags. It's been a very long day, and I find it hard to believe it all began early this morning back at Dreamland. My inflatable sleeping pad performs magnificently as it dutifully cushions me from the bumpy ground beneath. The night air is quiet, except for the occasional crackle of the dying fire, and a short distance away sits my faithful plane. I'll depend on it to not only entertain me for the next few days, but to deliver me safely home. With everything right in the world, I contently drift off into a deep slumber. With morning comes the sounds of squirrels gnawing on acorns and finches chirping and dropping twigs onto my tent. I awake to the smell of coffee brewing over an early morning campfire. I stumble out of my tent and fumble to insert my feet into my sandals. As I approach the fire's warmth, I give Rich a grunt and mumble, "Morning, how you doing?" Rich replies in an all-too-energetic voice, "All vital systems appearing to be functioning within reasonable parameters." Sitting on a stump close to the fire, I moan, "Glad to hear that, Rich. Is Dan up yet?" Rich responds, "Oh yeah, you didn't hear his plane earlier? He headed out to fetch us some breakfast." About that time, we hear the lonely drone of an ultralight's engine in the cool morning air. I peer out over the lake, bemused by rays of golden sunburst peeking over the hills to the east. Light begins to scatter through the early morning misty fog layered on the lake's glassy surface. Soon the hazy vapors are split by Dan's arrival in a hushed splashdown. His plane slides to a halt onto shore, and in one continuous motion he steps out of the plane and marches toward us, proudly holding a line of gleaming fish. As we all gather about the fire, we sip coffee and dine on the most delicious and fresh-tasting rainbow trout I could ever imagine.
Apparently, Dan is also an accomplished fly fisherman. Fortunately for us, he carries a small folding fly rod, and he's quite proficient in tying his own flies. Scraping the pan for the last remnants of trout, Dan describes an exquisite inlet he had discovered that morning while fishing. He says it's a dreamlike setting and is abundant with beautiful wildlife. The waters are teeming with hungry fish, and there are rare birds and herds of deer feeding along the water's edge. After cleaning our breakfast dishes and doing a quick but thorough check of our planes, we mount up to explore the area of the lake Dan had described. Heading northeast, we practice our formation flying as the chill of the morning air begins to subside with the sun's ascent. Approaching a fingered inlet, we skim along a shallow grassy shoreline. Submerged logs and rocks can be seen down through the clear bluish-green water. A herd of mule deer feed on the lush green grass and sip water all along the shore. Nearby is a beautiful snowy egret fishing the waters for its breakfast. Up ahead is a gathering of Canadian geese feeding and bathing in the shallows. Our progress leads us directly toward the large assembly of geese. As we approach, they begin to paddle and then run on top of the water, gaining speed. Flapping their powerful brown and white wings, they launch into the air, forming a modest-sized flock. By the time the geese are airborne and have reached our altitude, we find ourselves part of their congregation. The flock's speed matches ours closely, and only a few feet from us, their powerful wings pump them through the air, and their heads bob at the end of long, slender necks. I can feel the slight buffet of disturbed air as we trail the flock. I note that one does not want to fly too closely behind these large birds, for they occasionally release a terrifying variety of dangerous brown bomblets. We split off from the flock, peeling to the right to explore another finger of the lake. This cove contains grassy, golden-covered mounds, which form small rambling islands and peninsulas. Many of the humps and saddles protruding from the water have oak trees, which provide welcome shade for idle families of deer. The farther into the beautiful inlet we venture, the more frequent enticing sights appear. Our small planes fly rather slowly, but I wish I could slow them down even more to enjoy the stunning scenery slipping by. With Dan at lead, and Rich and I tucked tightly under each wing, we dip down to skip and skim our floats on the mirrored surface, leaving ripples in the otherwise undisturbed water. As wingmen, Rich and I shadow every subtle move of Dan's plane. We weave around the scattered islands in an elegant, coordinated ballet, with every motion graceful and effortless. My mind is not consciously aware of the control stick's movements, but my plane faithfully reacts to each of my whims and impulses. The pace of pleasant experiences continues to hasten as I begin to contemplate how this setting is just a little too perfect. It feels so good, I wonder if something bad is about to happen. Just like in the movies when everything seems idyllic, disaster can strike. But I return my focus and concentration to the task at hand. I strive to fly safely and keep the proper spacing from the lead and stay alert for trouble, but I also remind myself to relax and relish the moment. After we complete a steep bank in concert around to the left, we level over a flat part of one particular island, grazing only inches above the grassy terrain. Dan smoothly but smartly pulls his plane upward and tilts his wings over toward a singular ancient oak tree. Flying at treetop level, Dan's arm extends toward the tree with his finger pointing at a large twigged clump which looks like an extravagant nest. As we pass closely by, I see a majestic bird with a white head and neck feeding a fish to its chicks. It's our national bird, an American bald eagle. These birds were once rare and are now staging a comeback and inhabiting this beautiful lake. My eyes widen to mimic my mouth as I peer out at the eagle. Stunned by its glorious presence and strength, I feel a great honor to share the same sky with this fabulous creature. As we pass close by, the eagle pauses to give us a complacent look as if to say, "What big noisy birds you are! How do you ever expect to catch any fish?" Locked in taut formation, we leave the nest behind to gracefully swoop downward and sail out over the expansive blue lake. I gaze out beyond my naked toes, wiggling in the breeze before me, at the warm sun glinting off the water. Below is the delicate mirrored reflection of our own magnificent creations, inverted on the surface. If only I could somehow seize the moment's beauty, packaging and preserving it to enjoy forever. I experience a surreal calmness, yet each of my body senses is aroused to harvest the morning's brilliance. I am a happy witness to the beauty of motion, of nature, and of fraternity. The pure freedom of flight is accentuated by the personal satisfaction and accomplishment of being one with a machine I assembled with my very own hands. A machine I once feared has now become an extension of my every thought and reacts to my every impulse. What happens next takes me by surprise as I'm blindsided by this breathtaking feeling. Tears well up as I fight to focus on Dan's wing only inches away. A flood of emotions rushes throughout, permitting my spirit to be nourished from the splendor. My soul embraces the universe and finds perfection with all that is. At this particular moment in time, born on wings of discovery, I experience an awakening and conviction of faith. It's no particular denomination or religion, but sheer oneness with all that makes up the universe and everything living.